2014 in Slovenia, and we're going to be reading from Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 12, Devotional Service, Text 5. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Lesho dikatarastesham.
Lesho dikatarastesham.
Lesho dikatarastesham.
Lesho dikatarastesham.
Avyakta sakcha chetasam.
Avyakta sakcha chetasam.
Avyakta sakta chetasam.
Avyakta sakta chetasam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Dehavad vir avapyate.
Dehavad vir avapyate.
Dehavad vir avapyate.
Dehavad vir avapyate.
Klesho dikatarastesham.
Klesho dikatarastesham.
Avyakta sakta chetasam.
Avyakta sakta chetasam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Avyakta hi gatir dukam.
Dehavad bir avapyate.
Dehavad bir avapyate.
Would you have everybody chant also? Please.
Klesho dikatarastesham.
Klesho dikatarastesham.
Kleshaha.
Kleshaha.
Trouble.
Trouble.
Adhika taraha.
Adhika taraha.
Very much.
Very much.
Tesham.
Tesham.
Of them.
Of them.
Avyakta.
Avyakta.
To the unmanifested.
To the unmanifested.
Ashakta.
Ashakta.
Attached.
Attached.
Chetasam.
Chetasam.
Of those whose minds.
Of those whose minds.
Avyakta.
Avyakta.
Toward the unmanifested.
Toward the unmanifested.
He.
Is.
Certainly.
Certainly.
Gatihi.
Gatihi.
Progress.
Progress.
Dukam.
Dukam.
With trouble.
Dehavadvi.
Dehavadvi.
By the embodied.
Avapyate.
Is achieved.
Translation. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The group of transcendentalists who follow the path of the inconceivable, unmanifested, impersonal feature of the Supreme Lord are called jnana yogis, and persons who are in full Krishna consciousness, engage in devotional service to the Lord, are called bhakti yogis. Now, here the difference between Jnana Yoga and Bhakti Yoga is definitely expressed. The process of Jnana Yoga, although ultimately bringing one to the same goal, is very troublesome, whereas the path of Bhakti Yoga, the process of being in direct service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is easier and is natural for the embodied soul. The individual soul is embodied since time immemorial. It is very difficult for him to simply theoretically understand that he is not this body. Therefore, the bhakti yogi accepts the deity of Krishna as worshipable because there is some bodily conception fixed in the mind, which can thus be applied. Of course, worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his form within the temple is not idol worship. There is evidence in the Vedic literature that worship may be saguna or nirguna, of the supreme possessing or not possessing attributes. Worship of the deity in the temple is saguna worship, for the Lord is represented by material qualities. But the form of the Lord, although represented by material qualities such as stone, wood, or oil paint, is not actually material. That is the absolute nature of the Supreme Lord. A crude example may be given here. We may find some mailboxes on the street, and if we post our letters in those boxes, they will naturally go to their destination without difficulty. But any old box or an imitation which we may find somewhere, but which is not authorized by the post office, will not do the work. Similarly, God has an authorized representation in the deity form, which is called Archivigraha. This Archivigraha is an incarnation of the Supreme Lord. God will accept service through that form. The Lord is omnipotent, all-powerful. Therefore, by his incarnation as Archivigraha, he can accept the services of the devotee just to make it convenient for the man in conditioned life. So for a devotee, there is no difficulty in approaching the Supreme immediately and directly. But for those who are following the impersonal way to spiritual realization, the path is difficult. They have to understand the unmanifested representation of the Supreme through such Vedic literatures as the Upanishads. And they have to learn the language, understand the non-perceptual feelings. I have no idea what that means. I don't know what a non-perceptual feeling is. And realize all these processes. This is not easy for a common man. A person in Krishna consciousness, engaged in devotional service, simply by the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master, simply by offering regulative obeisances unto the deity, simply by hearing the glories of the Lord, and simply by eating the remnants of foodstuff offered to the Lord, realizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead very easily. There is no doubt that the impersonalists are unnecessarily taking a troublesome path with the risk of not realizing the absolute truth at the ultimate end. But the personalist, without any risk, trouble, or difficulty, approaches the Supreme Personality directly. A similar passage appears in Srimad Bhagavatam. It is stated there that if one ultimately has to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this surrendering process is called bhakti, but instead takes the trouble to understand what is Brahman, what is not Brahman, and spends his whole life in that way, the result is simply troublesome. Therefore, it is advised here that one should not take up this troublesome path of self-realization because there is uncertainty in the ultimate result. A living entity is eternally an individual soul, and if he wants to merge into the spiritual whole, he may accomplish the realization of the eternal and knowledgeable aspects of his original nature, but the blissful portion is not realized. By the grace of some devotee, such a transcendentalist, highly learned in the process of Jnana Yoga, may come to the point of Bhakti Yoga or devotional service. At that time, long practice in impersonalism also becomes a source of trouble because he cannot give up the idea. Therefore, an embodied soul is always in difficulty with the unmanifest, both at the time of practice and at the time of realization. Every living soul is partially independent, and one should know for certain that this unmanifested realization is against the nature of his spiritual, blissful self. One should not take up this process. For every individual living entity, the process of Krishna consciousness, which entails full engagement in devotional service, is the best way. If one wants to ignore this devotional service, there is a danger of turning to atheism. Thus, the process of centering attention on the unmanifested, the inconceivable, which is beyond the approach of the senses, as already expressed in this verse, should never be encouraged at any time, especially in this age. It is not advised by Lord Krishna. We might note that at the very end of this chapter, in the very last purport, there, Srila Prabhupada says, the impersonal conception of the Supreme Absolute Truth as described in this chapter is recommended only up to the time one surrenders himself for self-realization. In other words, as long as one does not have the chance to associate with a pure devotee, the impersonal conception may be beneficial. So it's interesting that in this purport for 12.5, Srila Prabhupada says that it should not be encouraged at any time. It should never be encouraged at any time, especially in this age. But in the last purport, he says that it actually can be encouraged and it can be beneficial for people in a particular situation. Klesho dikatarastesham avyaktasak chetasam avyaktam hikatirajukam dehabhadvirapite. For those whose minds are attached to the unmanifested impersonal feature of the Supreme, advancement is very troublesome. To make progress in that discipline is always difficult for those who are embodied. So this verse is part of an answer to a question that was asked at the beginning of this chapter. And it's a quite an important question because it applies to anyone who wants to become enlightened. So if you're not particularly interested in becoming enlightened, then I don't think this class will be very interesting for you. So if you're interested in just like making money and having a big house and having a BMW and a Jaguar in the garage, then we're not going to talk about that today. So it's the wrong class. So this is a class about how to become enlightened, how to become completely spiritually realized in the fastest, easiest way. So that's what we're aiming at today. And Arjuna asks a question. There's our Arjuna there in the picture. So he asks a question at the beginning of this chapter. And his question is, what's the fastest way to enlightenment? So he's talking to Krishna, who's the Supreme Lord, as a Supreme Person, with a spiritual form, with eyes and nose and mouth and hands and so forth. And he's saying to him, okay, Krishna, you've told me already, this is chapter 12, so Krishna's already made it quite clear that yoginam api sarvesham madgaten antaratman shradavam bhajate yomam samayuktatmo mataha, that the best yogi is one who's absorbed in Krishna in love. And so then Arjuna says, should I start with that? If I'm going to start on the spiritual journey, what should I start with? Should I start with trying to love the Supreme Person? Or maybe what I should do is first become pure. And then I can love God. Should I try to love God from the first day? Or should I first become pure and then love God? So this is not just some theoretical, esoteric question of 5,000 years ago. But I find that this is a problem for many, 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 many people on the path of spiritual life. In fact, it's probably one of the most common difficulties and stumbling blocks for anyone who takes up the process of bhakti yoga. I run into this misconception over and over and over and over again. I think one of the reasons that we have this question is brought up also in the Srimad Bhagavatam, where King Parikit, Emperor Parikit, asked the question, we have a material mind, and we have a material tongue, material eyes, material senses. How can we possibly realize God through something material? It's just not possible. You know, if we start off in the very beginning of spiritual enlightenment, saying that, okay, I'm just going to start loving God, I'm starting to becoming attached to Krishna, you know, I'm just not going to be able to do it. I can't see him. I don't really understand my relationship with him. I don't really know how I'm going to love him. I'm just too contaminated. I'm too polluted. It's just not going to work. So first I have to become purified, and then I can do it. So this, people think like this quite a lot. So it's something like, so this glass has water in it, but I'd like you to pretend that it's not water, if you have a good imagination. It's kind of hard because it's a clear glass, so if it wasn't a clear glass, we'll just pretend it's not a clear glass. So let's say that in this cup there was some chemical juice. Do they sell that here in Slovenia? Can you buy that in the shops? It's water, sugar, or sometimes it's not even real sugar. Sometimes it's aspartamine or some crazy chemical. So, you know, water, sugar, or fake sugar, and some coloring, and then some flavor like fruit juice. And maybe there's like 1% fruit juice, maybe. Right? So in America, they call this juicy juice. And you can buy a big gallon jug of it, you know, great big jug, very cheap, because it's basically just water. right, with a little color and flavor, and maybe a little natural fruit juice. So let's say you had a cup full of that, and you realized that this wasn't very healthy for you, that you wanted instead to have real juice. So you could do it in several ways. You could take your fake juice, your juicy juice, and you could pour it out. And then you would have an empty cup. And then if you really wanted to get it clean, you could like scrub the cup, right? Get some soap and a scrub and really and get all these little things here and get every single molecule of the chemical juice out of the cup and have a completely empty cup. And then you could fill it with your real juice. So that would be one way to do it. Or what you could do is you could just simply take your real juice and start pouring it into the cup. Now, if you started pouring the real juice into the cup, you would have a mix in the cup of chemical juice and real juice. And the more you kept pouring, the percentage of the mix would change to real juice. And after some time, the cup would only be filled with real juice. Now, if you think about the two different experiences, if you do the first way, you have to empty your cup. You have to have an empty cup. Does that make sense to everybody? You have to have an empty cup. The other way, you never have an empty cup. Now, if you could do it very fast, if you could like, if you could do the whole thing in about 2 seconds, then it might make sense to do it the other way. Because you'd never have to have a situation where things were mixed. But unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. Because it's not natural for the soul to be empty. And that's the point that Srila Prabhupada is making in this purport. Krishna says, klesho and dukkham. Klesha is trouble and dukkha is misery. And Krishna says, you can do it that way. It will work. But it will be trouble and misery. And elsewhere in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, if you try to become enlightened that way, bahunam janmanam ante. Bahunam means many, janmanam means birth, ante means the end. It will take you many, 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 many births. It will be such a long process that you probably will not even finish it in this life. And the main reason for that is that it is not natural for a spiritual being to be empty. And Srila Prabhupada makes a fascinating point in this purport that he says it's trouble to do it, and then after you've done it, it's also trouble. So I think of a very instructive story in this regard. My nephew went to a very religious school where it was only a boys' school, and they had rules that the boys were not allowed to date any girls. They weren't allowed to talk to any girls. And once they wanted to marry, they would go to their religious mentor, their religious guide, and they'd say, now I want to marry. So my nephew, when he got to be, I don't remember, 21, 22, he went to his mentor and says, now I would like to get married. Would you please help me find a suitable woman? And his mentor says, yes, we can, you know, inquire in the community, and the community he was in, they did kind of, not arranged marriages, but arranged introductions. So he said, we can find a nice girl, I'll introduce you to her. He said, but all these years you haven't looked at any young women. So when I introduce you to a girl, you have to look at her. So it's the problem, you know, if you've gone for, you know, from the time you're 12 years old, when you would first maybe have some interest in looking at girls, until you're 22, always looking at their feet, then all of a sudden you're going to meet the girl you're going to marry and you still want to look at her feet. Right? You're not willing to look at her face. So this is the problem. That when a person tries to become empty, it's very hard to become empty. It's not who we are. We're not empty beings. To say, I'm going to get rid of all desires, I'm going to get rid of all feelings, I'm going to get rid of all thoughts, I'm going to get rid of all activities. I'm going to have nothing. So because it's unnatural to have nothing, it's extremely difficult. If you've ever tried to clear your mind of all thoughts, even for 10 seconds or 30 seconds. You know how difficult it is. And not only is it very difficult, it can have very negative consequences. You know, if you try to clear your heart of all emotion and all desires, then you become like, you know, a piece of furniture. When I was young, there was a famous song, "I Am a Rock." So you become like a rock. I mean, this Christian has no emotions. It has no desires. Or I'm sure most of you have computers or smartphones or tablets or something like that. So it has no emotions, right? You can train your computer to think. Your computer can play chess and even you cheat in chess. So it can think. That requires thinking, yes? You cannot play chess without thinking. But it has no emotions. When the computer wins the game, it doesn't care. It just doesn't care. If it loses, it doesn't care. If it never plays a game, it doesn't care. You know, if you practice for a chess game and you practice for a year to play chess and then you go to the tournament and you're not allowed to play, you would be very disappointed, yes? I practiced for a year, I've prepared, and now I can't even play. But the computer doesn't feel like that. The computer doesn't say, wait a minute, I have this amazing program for playing chess. You spent, you know, 300 euros on this program for playing chess, and now you're not going to even let me play? The computer doesn't care. It has no desires. The computer doesn't care when you turn it off at night. Oh, don't turn me off. It has no desires. So if you try to become empty of emotions and desires, what are you trying to become? A machine? A rock? And therefore, if people achieve this, first of all, it's very, very difficult because it's going against our spiritual nature, as Srila Prabhupada says in this purport. It goes against the blissful nature of the soul. There's no bliss in emptiness. There's no bliss. I mean, it may be peaceful. Like if you go to your home and you just get rid of all the furniture, you know, you get rid of everything in your home. It's peaceful. There's nothing to clean. There's nothing to maintain. But there's nothing to enjoy either. Like all the people we have in our life, even the people who we love, they're sometimes troublesome, yes? Even the people we love the most, sometimes they're a problem. So if we got rid of all the people in our life, no more people in our life, that would be more peaceful. We would never argue with anyone. We'd never have a difference of opinion. We would never have to compromise or negotiate. But it would be lonely. So that's against the blissful nature of the self. So if you can do that, you're doing something artificial, extremely difficult. And then once you've done that, after many, 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 many births, and you've got that empty cup, guess what? It's hard to put the real juice in it then. It becomes difficult to fill it up with the real thing. As Prabhupada says, one cannot give up the practice. One gets stuck. Just like we see some people who deal with difficulty in their life by becoming hard-hearted. I'm sure we've all met people like this. Maybe we have been like this. You know, we've gone through someone goes through some difficulty in their life and they just try to make their heart like a rock. They try to become very cold. Sometimes you see this in relationships. So I was visiting a family one time that was like this. The husband and wife, they had become angry at each other about something. And from that one thing they had become angry with each other about, they were very cold and hard with each other. Everything the other person did was bad. Here, would you like some water? Why are you giving me water? Are you trying to tell me what to do? You know, everything became this filter of negativity. And when you wanted to try to change it, it was very difficult. When you wanted to say, maybe your wife is giving you water because she cares about you. People get stuck there. They get stuck in the coldness and the hardness. So therefore, although this path can work, first empty the cup and then fill it with love of God, and then fill it with spiritual activities, and then fill it with beauty, and then fill it with personality. Although that can work, it's a bona fide path. It's a real path. It's a path given in the scriptures. It's not a very good path. Yes, it takes you there. Just like you can give somebody directions. You know, you can get there this way, this way, this way. But if that's a dirt road, and it winds all through the fields, and there's big holes in it, and there's a shaky bridge, and this is just a nice paved, smooth road. So this path particularly here is identified as Jnana Yoga, although people sometimes follow this path also through Karma Yoga or Jnana Yoga. But especially Jnana Yoga, Jnana Yoga is you try to make yourself empty through detachment, through philosophy. You look at the world and you say, yuck. There's a lot to say yuck about in material life. You say, look, everything's temporary, dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It's miserable and then it's temporary. So you get a little bit of happiness here and there, sometimes. You never get unlimited happiness. And then whatever little bit of happiness you get, a chapulasukha, it's like a drop of water on the waxy leaf of a lily or like on the back of a duck. It doesn't stay. It doesn't stay. You get some enjoyment from your new house and then your pipes break and you have to fix it. You know, you get some enjoyment from your beautiful, youthful body, and then it gets old or it gets sick or something. Right? So there's some pleasure, but it doesn't stay. And you see the nature of material relationships. Material relationships are full of exploitation. They're full of selfishness. And if you really see the nature of material relationships and you really see the nature of materialistic happiness, it's actually not very attractive. So that is the path of Jnana Yoga. The path of Jnana Yoga is you detach yourself from ordinary material activities and you study philosophy, especially you study the philosophy in the scriptures. And by studying this philosophy and meditating on this philosophy, you become so detached that you become gradually over many, 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 many lifetimes empty. Now, as we say, many times people, even who take up the path of bhakti yoga or Krishna consciousness, have this misconception that first they should become empty and then they can think about Krishna. Now, they have this misconception for several reasons. One of them is they're thinking, well, if I just start thinking of Krishna now, it'll be all mixed up with material things. If I start meditating on Krishna now, in a materially contaminated state, how am I going to meditate on Krishna? As we said at the beginning, I don't really know Krishna. I haven't really seen Krishna. I'm just going to look at a painting and think about the painting, which is not exactly the same thing because I'm just seeing it as a painting. Or I'll just look at, you know, the sculpture, the deity form. Or I'll just have some imagination in my mind based on the scriptures, and I'm going to mix all my material ideas with it, and so it won't be very pure, and so I better not do that. But that is the process of bhakti yoga. And Krishna very strongly recommends from day one, from the very beginning, when you're basically completely filled with impurities and completely filled with material conceptions, at that time, Maya Shakta Manaparta, start thinking of me, Krishna says, with attachment. Not just start thinking of me, but start thinking of me, Krishna says, with attachment. And indeed, Krishna describes so many ways, and Prabhupada refers so many ways in this purport, that even somebody who's completely materially conditioned can start bhakti yoga in a totally contaminated state. Now, why does that work? So we were talking about the question earlier where the sages said, how can you think of the spiritual with the material? How can you use material sounds? How can you use a material tongue, a material mind, to understand the Supreme? And the answer was given that this world is not simply material. That these bodies, these senses, they're designed for a dual purpose. It's like a lock, a key. A key is designed to lock you in, and it's also designed to unlock. Yes? It's designed to lock and unlock. A lock is designed to keep you in and also designed to get you out. So this material world is designed for two purposes, opposite purposes, depending on how you want to use it, depending on what you want to do with it. And therefore, all the things that entangle us can also be used to liberate us. You don't, therefore, have to get rid of them. It's not necessary, it's not natural, it's very difficult, and it will cause difficulty in the process, and it will cause difficulty even if you achieve full emptiness. We just had a verse in the Bhagavatam at the temple of Rubiana in the morning, that one in the proper consciousness does not really see anything material. One in the proper consciousness sees that everything is ultimately spiritual. Sarva kalam idam brahma. Srila Prabhupada also writes in the Krishna book, chapter 20, that a materialist sees the world as very aggressive. But to the devotee, everything appears to be happily situated. Earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 4, it says that if one is in the proper consciousness, everything becomes transcendental. The person, what they're doing, the result of what they're doing, everything becomes spiritual. Sarva kalam idam brahma. Everything is ultimately spiritual. What we call materialism is not a thing. It's not that a materialistic person owns a car and a spiritual person doesn't. Or a materialistic person has, you know, a family and a spiritual person doesn't. It's not that being spiritual means being empty. It's explained very nicely in the 20th chapter of the 10th canto, in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto, sorry, that illusion exists only in one place, within the mind. It's simply a way of perceiving. Materialism simply means that I am perceiving things wrongly. I am perceiving things in a way that they are not. I am perceiving things differently than what they are. So I don't need to get rid of anything. I need to simply change my perception. Now, if I change my perception, I will also perhaps, have different things. And I will also use what I have and use my relationships differently. But that's because I've changed my perception first. So what is the difference? What happens in bhakti yoga that one tries to change? It's actually quite simple. The concept is quite simple. Doing it, my dear friends, is also difficult. It's not as difficult as emptying your cup. But it is difficult simply because it seems rather frightening to us. It seems to take us a while before we have the courage and the faith to do it completely. Therefore, we say bhakti is also a gradual process. But although it's gradual, it's much, much faster. It's possible, very possible, to achieve full perfection in bhakti yoga in this lifetime. In fact, it's theoretically possible, though it rarely happens, for someone to achieve perfection bhakti yoga instantly. Whereas trying to achieve perfection through jnana yoga through first becoming empty is extremely difficult. So what is it that has to be changed? The idea that I am the center and I am the most important being in all of creation. That I am always right, that I am always perfect on a material level, that everything revolves around me, that everybody is here for my satisfaction, everything, everybody, everything. You know, the weather revolves around me, everything. Whatever happens is because of me. Which is, from a logical point of view, obviously absurd. Nobody would believe such a thing logically. If you say to anybody, excuse me, sir, excuse me, ma'am, are you the center of the universe? Yeah. Are you the most important person in Slovenia? Is Slovenia the most important country in the world? I'm sure it is, but you know. Actually, probably America is the most important country. You know, is this planet the most important planet in the solar system? Is the solar system the most important solar system in the Milky Way? Is the Milky Way the most important galaxy in the universe? Is this the only universe? Yeah, everybody can understand that this is ridiculous. The sad truth is that, my dear friends, when we die, only a few people will care for a very short time. That's the truth. A few people. 10, 20, maybe if you're really popular, 100 or 200. And they won't care for very long, really. They really won't. And the whole world will just go on just fine. The buildings won't collapse, you know. Land won't fall into the sea, and all the economies won't fall apart. So this idea that I'm the center of the universe, that everything revolves around me, that everybody is here for my pleasure. You know, my mother, my father, my husband, my wife, my children, my dog, my cat, my government, my friends, they all exist to make me happy because I am the most important and I am always right and everybody should always agree with me, and if you don't agree with me, I will give you a very hard time. I will try to convince you to agree with me by manipulation, by bargaining, you know, by yelling at you, by whatever. It's madness. It's actually a kind of insanity. It's no less insanity than someone who thinks they're Napoleon or something. So, you know, we know that that is crazy. And that's what needs to be given up. Something that is illogical, unreasonable, obviously false. But which we are very comfortable with. You know, we are very, very comfortable with this. And that's why, that's what is difficult about bhakti yoga. What is difficult about bhakti yoga is that we are very comfortable with this idea that I am the most important being anywhere. And that everything is meant to please me, and everything is meant to satisfy me, and I am the center of all existence. And it's a very comfortable idea. Again, we don't say it quite like that, because if we said it like that, we wouldn't have any friends. But that's actually how we're thinking. That's the essence of what we're thinking and what's driving us. And we're comfortable with that. And we're afraid that if we give it up, then we'll have to face the fact that we're very small and insignificant and that nothing really revolves around me at all. And that will just be sort of miserable. So we really don't want to give it up. And that's what makes bhakti yoga difficult. And that's really the only thing that makes bhakti yoga difficult. The practices we do, which some people may find difficult in a practical way, like chanting 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna mantra every day, or giving up illicit sex, or giving up gambling, or something like that. Really, those are not the things that are difficult, although some people may find them extremely difficult for some period of time. What is definitely difficult is saying, you know, I'm just a spiritual spark in creation. And my importance and my meaning and my value come only because of love. Because Krishna loves me, therefore, I am very important, and I do have a lot of meaning, and I do have a lot of value. But otherwise, no, I don't. And Prabhupada gives the example of a little screw inside of a machine, that when the little screw is inside of the machine, it's very valuable. But if the screw is out of the machine, just lying on the ground, it has no value at all. So when we have our, when we are experiencing that connection with Krishna, we are indeed valuable. That's the irony. That when I'm again connected with Krishna, I am indeed valuable. And I am important. And I really matter. But as soon as I try to be important and valuable and matter independently, then I have no value practically at all. Just a moment in time, with very little impact on anything, and then forgotten. So bhakti yoga is one changes from the false to the true. Come from the darkness to the light, from the false to the true, from the unreal to the real. The real is that God is the center, that Krishna is the center. He has always been the center. He is the center. He always will be the center. And I can be in the center with him, but not independently. I can be important and valuable in love for him. As Prabhupada says, the whole world is full of Krishna's singing, but different people hear it differently. And Krishna is always dancing, and if we dance with him, we become happy, and if we try to dance independently or with someone else, we become unhappy. And that's bhakti yoga. That's it. It's really all it is. And everything that we do, our chanting, our offering of vegetarian food, our studying the scriptures, our dedicating everything to Krishna, is both a means of understanding reality and a way of expressing reality already understood. But that's basically all bhakti yoga is. Put Krishna in the center, who's already in the center. See things as they are. Change one's vision. That will mean that one stops going around thinking that I'm great on a material level as the center in the universe. And one starts thinking, my greatness is that Krishna loves me. My greatness is that I'm a spiritual being that's part and parcel of God. That's my greatness. My greatness isn't that everyone is meant to serve me. My greatness is that everyone is meant to serve Krishna, and I have my greatness when I am part of that harmony. Something like so many musical instruments in a symphony. And each player, each musician is great when they are playing in harmony. They're individuals. It's not that they're not individuals. But the greatness is when they play in harmony. And sometimes a player may play an individual solo also. But even that individual solo is part of the harmonious whole. So the path of Gyan Yoga says, let's have silence. And the path of Bhakti says, let's have music. A materialistic person only hears noise. The reason a materialistic person only hears noise is because a materialistic person is vibrating their own instrument out of harmony. When you vibrate your own instrument out of harmony, even though the whole universe is in harmony, you only hear noise. The universe is not full of noise. It's full of beautiful music. But as soon as we play our own instrument out of harmony, we only hear noise. The Jnani Yogi says, make it silent. The Bhakti Yogi says, start playing in harmony. So that is Bhakti Yoga in a nutshell. And later on in this chapter, Krishna gives a very wonderful explanation of gradual steps to bhakti yoga. So he says, you perform the highest level of bhakti yoga. If you can't do that, do this, you can't do that, do this, you can't do that, do this, you can't do that, do this. And then at the end of the chapter, you just do the key verses, right?
Yeah.
So at the end of the chapter, Krishna describes the wonderful qualities that naturally happen, when somebody practices bhakti yoga. Now, these will also happen if somebody practices jnana yoga, but again, that's with a lot of trouble. So here's some of the qualities that naturally happen. One will not be envious. One will be a kind friend to all living entities. One won't think that one owns anything. One won't think, this is mine for my own purposes. One will be free from false ego. In other words, one will be free from arrogance and pride. One will feel equal in material happiness and material distress. So external circumstances will no longer control our happiness. Our happiness will be within. We'll no longer be slaves to our conditions and our circumstances. Who's always satisfied, who has full determination in bhakti, and our mind and intelligence fixed on the Supreme. One will not put anyone else into difficulty. There'll be no reason to put anyone else into difficulty, because when one is fully in bhakti yoga, one has everything one needs in connection with Krishna. Why should I put anyone else into difficulty? And who is not disturbed by anyone. So if someone else is in materialistic consciousness and they're trying to get something from you, but you're already in harmony with Krishna, you have everything you need, and then you just feel compassion for this person, but you're not disturbed by them. Equal poise and happiness and distress again. Fear and anxiety. So fearful and anxious situations will no longer affect one, because one knows, I'm an eternal soul. Not dependent on the ordinary course of activity, so not needing any particular circumstance in order to be happy, in order to function, in order to be spiritual. Who's pure, who's expert. So one in this proper consciousness of bhakti yoga becomes expert in everything they do, even materially. It's not that a spiritual person becomes useless materially. Without cares. So Srila Prabhupada talks about in this purport that such a person doesn't take the part of any party. They don't join any faction. They don't say, okay, I'm a member of this group and not that group, and this is us and them, and we're right and you're wrong. He says, therefore he is carefree, free from all pains. So at this point, one does not even feel the material pains. Not striving for some result. So you already have everything that you need. So therefore, one can work in the world as a service to Krishna with great enthusiasm and great determination, but not to try to get any particular result for oneself, because one already has everything. Who neither rejoices nor grieves. So such a person is always rejoicing internally at their own spiritual nature and the spiritual nature of God. Therefore, if they get something wonderful in the world or nasty in the world, it doesn't really matter. Who neither laments nor desires, who renounces auspicious and inauspicious things. For such a person, there's nothing good or bad. Everything's good. Everything's favorable, because everything's spiritual and God is everywhere. They don't need nice situations or not nice situations, even for their spiritual life. Equal to friends and enemies. They're not hating anybody. Having compassion and love for everyone. That doesn't mean you live with everybody. It doesn't mean you have to, you know, bring a tiger into your bedroom. Still have a wall between you and the tigers in life. But you don't hate anybody. Equal poise in honor and dishonor. So not to be controlled, whether everyone says you're wonderful or everyone says you're terrible. So all the whole world says you're terrible. What does it matter? The whole world's going to forget you, you know, a month after you're dead anyway. What does it matter? One already has one's full satisfaction within and all honor from God. Who cares if some people in the world dishonor you or honor you? Heat and cold, that just applies to the body, which we are not. Again, happiness and distress, fame and infamy. Always satisfied with anything. Why? Because one is full from within. Who doesn't care for any residence? This is my home, my homeland. Fixed in knowledge, who always sees things the way that they are. As Krishna says earlier in the sixth chapter, once coming to this stage, one never departs from the truth. One sees the truth always, not just a little glimmer here and there. And who's engaged in loving service to the Supreme. So thank you very much. Do we have time for questions, or should we just... How much time?
15 minutes.
Okay. I hope I spoke slowly enough. Were you all able to understand my English?
Perfectly.
Perfectly, okay.
Yeah, I was.
You... That's my grandson, by the way. Yes?
So, why is it so difficult to not be in the center? Why is it so difficult?
Why is it so difficult to give up the false ego and get out of the center? Well, first of all, we're comfortable with it. And second of all, we're afraid that if we give up this false idea, that we'll have nothing. Pretty simple. So this may be false, and I know it's false, and everyone else knows it's false, and it's not working because it's false, so obviously it can't work. But it's all I have. I mean, better to have chemical juice than nothing, you know. It's what I have. So maybe I get a little happiness from imagining on the center sometimes, and sometimes other people do what I want them to do, and sometimes the weather does what I want it to do, and sometimes I get what I want, if I'm really clever, and luck is with me. So, because it works a little bit sometimes. I'm afraid if I give that up, I might have nothing that ever works at all. Also, I may be afraid that if I have Krishna as the center, that he won't be very nice. That if I serve Krishna, it'll be, you know, like some kind of a dictator. Some exploitive boss. You know, some company in some remote corner of the world that engages children in slave labor to make your phones. So, you know, I think it'll be like that. Someone who kidnaps 9-year-old girls, telling them they'll have a career in dancing, and forces them into prostitution. Beats them. So I think God will be like that. That I'll say, okay, I'll get out of the center, Krishna, and I'll acknowledge that you're in the center, and I'll serve you. And he'll say, oh, good. I was just waiting for it. Be my slave. So we're afraid of that. No, actually, we're afraid of that. We're afraid, you know, what I have now, pretending that I'm the center, when I know I'm not the center, and everyone else knows I'm not the center, because they're all pretending to be the center too. You know, we all know that. And, you know, all my friends know how foolish I am. And I know how foolish they are. We all know that we're all just lying about who and what we are. But, you know, I've got something. And I feel I have some freedom, and I have something. And if I surrender to Krishna, who knows? What is he going to do? So it's wise. Quite simple. Right? Something like the person who gets addicted to some sort of drug. Someone gets addicted to alcohol or heroin or cocaine or something like that. They know it's miserable. Probably the first couple times they took the drug, it was fun. Then after a while, it really wasn't fun anymore. After a while, it was just misery. But they don't know how to live without it. And they're afraid, if I give it up, I'll have nothing. you know, that they know that it's killing them. And they know it's making them into a horrible person. They know it's damaging all their relationships. But their body has become accustomed to it. And they're afraid. So we've become very accustomed to lying about who and what we are. We become accustomed to living a lie. We're comfortable with it to some extent. And we're afraid that maybe the truth is worse than the lie. So therefore we say in Bhakti Yoga that having, I mean there's many reasons, this is only one of them, but we say that the association of other devotees is very important. And hearing the scriptures is very important. Because this gives us some faith that Krishna is a supreme friend and that he's very loving. It gives us faith that we don't gain anything from living a lie. It doesn't give us anything, zero, nothing. That whatever very temporary and slight pleasures we have will get millions of times more in the truth. And that Krishna is very loving. And that Krishna doesn't want to take away our freedom. In fact, we'll have a gazillion times more freedom if we surrender. Just like an honest citizen has a lot more freedom than a prisoner in the jail. Yeah, if you're an honest citizen, you have to follow the laws of the country. That's true. But Krishna's laws are really simple. Now, when you're learning Bhakti Yoga, it doesn't look like that. It looks like they're very complicated. There's this rule and that rule and this rule and the other rule and the other rule. But when one is finally free from this false ego, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Bhakti Loka says there's only two rules that Krishna asks you to follow. That's it. Have love and don't envy. And that is nothing else. And as long as you're full of love and you don't have any envy, you can do whatever you want. You're completely free. You can go wherever you want. You can do whatever you want. You can be in the spiritual world where there's desire trees, and whatever you want is immediately there. Why? Because you won't use anything to harm yourself or others. If you only have love and no envy, you won't want evil things, and you won't do evil with anything. And therefore, there's no need of any other rule. You know, for those people who have love of God, there's not a big rule book. There's not a rule book at all. There's not a police force. There's not. It just doesn't exist. But we think, you know, if there's such a big rule book in the material world, then if I surrender to Krishna, it'll be even bigger. But it's exactly the opposite. By association with especially advanced devotees and reading the scriptures, we gradually get the experiences to believe it. It gradually becomes real to us. We start experiencing, oh, Krishna's actually nice. And I'm really suffering by being an illusion. This illusion is really nasty, and the reality is really nice. And as we become convinced of that more and more and more, you know, you start pouring the real juice in your cup, you pour a few drops in, and just a few drops makes a difference. You're like, wow, this tastes a lot better. You know, you pour a little bit more in, oh wow, this tastes even better. Oh, I have more energy. And then you get the faith to do that. Anything else? Yes.
It's really connected with this. We are part and parcel of Krishna, and we are here because we want to be God, we want to be the center of the universe. And also Krishna has humility, so we also have this humility. And what you read in the end, it's like when you have humility, you have all these good qualities. Mm. Automatically, it's not natural.
Yes.
So why is so prominent this to be in the center? Why is humility not so prominent as
we can choose. We can choose. Frankly, because we are part of Krishna, this desire on our part to try to be Krishna is not such a difficult thing to understand. It's just we're not able to do that. No, we can experience things from Krishna's perspective in love. Just like Krishna, Krishna's beloveds, the cowherd girls, the gopis, when Krishna leaves in the middle of the rasa dance, they start experiencing things from Krishna's perspective, as if they are Krishna, yes? You know that story? So we actually, as a little soul, we can experience things from Krishna's perspective. But we can have a doubt, maybe it's not the full deal. We can't have the full deal, we're small. You couldn't have a reality where there's an unlimited number of equal competing gods. That's not beauty. That's not harmony. If you had a symphony where everybody could just play their own instrument however they wanted, then that's just noise. So that's not reality. Each person in the symphony can have a solo role as part of the symphony. Does that make sense to you? It's the old question. How come I'm so foolish? And the problem with that question is that it's a circular one. In other words, we can't understand how foolish we are while we're in illusion about how great we are. So the reality of how foolish we are to think that we're at the center makes no sense to us while we're in false ego. It just doesn't. You can't even understand it. So as long as you're thinking, you know, I am great materially, and I am the center, and I am the most important materially, then to try to understand, that's a really foolish way to think. It just doesn't matter. But as you advance in bhakti yoga, and you start understanding that Krishna is the center, then it becomes very easy to understand also how we can be that foolish. That it can't really be comprehended at the beginning. It just can't. It's incompatible. When we're full of arrogance, to try to understand that I am such an incredible fool that I willingly have put myself into this illusion. I'm sure you know that many people who are addicted to alcohol or drugs don't realize that they're addicts. Yes? Many. It's quite common. You know, that an alcoholic doesn't, they don't understand they're an alcoholic. One of the hardest things to do, probably the hardest thing to do for someone who's addicted to some substance, is just to convince them that they are addicted. You know, any of us who work with counseling or therapy, the hardest thing to convince somebody of is that they have a problem. Even in our regular life, right? Somebody we love and care about has some kind of a problem that's making them miserable and making everybody else miserable. And we say, look, you have this problem and it's making you miserable and it's making everybody, oh, I don't have that problem. Well, you know, we provide them with all the evidence. You're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this, and it bothers this person, it bothers, it's not bothering anybody, that's their problem that it bothers them. Yes? I'm fine. I have nothing to fix. That they're just too sensitive. And it can take years, yes? Years for for somebody to say, oh wow, I actually have a problem. I mean, whether it's a small thing like leaving your dirty laundry all over the floor, or whether it's a big thing, you know, like beating your wife. I mean, it takes people often years just to say, oh, I actually have a problem. Am I correct? And maybe we've experienced this ourselves. I've experienced this, that people have told me for years, Ormila, you have a problem with this. And I'll say, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I don't really hear it. And then one day, all of a sudden, I hear it. Wow, I actually have a problem. I'm doing something wrong. I need to fix it. And people have been telling me for 20 years. Have you experienced this kind of thing? So this is the same thing. When we say that it's our own foolish choice to be an illusion, we don't believe it. We just say, oh, come on, there's no way I could have made such a foolish choice. I'm not doing that. Impossible. Must be Krishna's fault. Must be some other explanation. But at a certain point of purification, one will see, yes, I am making this choice, and I am doing this thing, even though it makes absolutely no sense, and is really damaging me. But you can't force that on people. You know, you can say it, but people will come to see it in their own time. That's the best I can do. Okay, we can have one more and then we need to stop. Anybody else have a question? Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, Gita.